You're listening to Square One, a podcast where we interview entrepreneurs, investors, and executives at the cutting edge of business. I'm your host, Alex Rianzi, and our guest today is Caitlin Long. Caitlin is a co-founder of the Wyoming Blockchain Coalition and former chairman and president of Symbiont, an enterprise blockchain company. Before diving into the Bitcoin and blockchain communities full-time, Caitlin spent 22 years in Wall Street running Morgan Stanley's pension business, holding senior roles at Credit Suisse, and she began her career at Salomon Brothers.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
I've been thinking a lot lately, and I know you have, about where Bitcoin's going 5 years out, 10 years out. And as I've thought through the benefits and maybe the obstacles to Bitcoin becoming a global reserve currency, which at least I know is an opinion that you hold and have spoken a lot about before, I've been thinking about it in three prongs. You know, one is what might benefits be, which is a debate, and two, a hard currency. In the case of Bitcoin, effectuated via a decentralized network. Two, obstacles in place from incumbents who could be displaced by a decentralized hard currency, and that being central banks, but also the parties that are deeply ingrained in and reliant upon the existing fiat system. And then three, maybe the technological hurdles. So in the case of Bitcoin, the ones most often spoken about are scalability, the energy footprint, and maybe some alternative consensus mechanisms. Maybe to kick things off, and I know you've spoken at length about your studies into Austrian economics and some of the alternative schools of thought that profess the benefits of a hard currency. What are those, and what are the benefits, in your opinion, or the logic for a hard currency in the economy and for society at large?
Well, hard currency is what enables the stability of human relations. If you look at the most unstable times in history and the most unstable countries today, they oftentimes have a common thread running through them, which is unfair, unsound money. And by that I mean, when I'm talking about about money, I'm talking about an honest ledger. That's all money really is. The medium of exchange and store of value that we learned about in our economics classes are uses of money. But money is actually even more abstract than that. Money is an accounting system. And when that accounting system is dishonest and gets abused, it starts to create social tensions and geopolitical tensions. And boy, do we have a lot of those. It also foments instability in financial systems. And anyone with a perspective on the history of U.S. financial markets will understand that the biggest crashes in the U.S. financial history were preceded by periods of dishonesty in money. And I would argue that we've been in one of those now, and the stability that we have, of course, in the last few weeks, it seems unstable in securities markets. But it's the stability that we've had in recent years is a mirage. The foundations upon which our financial system are built are very unstable, inherently unstable, and we will have a continuation of the trend of corrections in greater amplitude and in shorter periods of time in between the corrections. It's the entirely foreseeable impact of having unstable, dishonest money.
And so, just, I guess, implicit in that, you know, in using the financial crisis as an example, is that absent the interventionist monetary policies leading up to 2006, 2007, 2008, the conditions for the fallout just wouldn't have existed in the first place. That's kind of how that framework logic applies to the most recent financial crisis.
Yes, and the financial crisis is not the problem. It's the symptom of the underlying problem, which is that we do not have any idea, none of us has any idea, where the price of borrowing money would be in the absence of all the interventions that we have in the world today. It's not just in the United States, not even just in the Western world. Mm-hmm. There is not free money anywhere in the world except in the cryptocurrency ecosystem. And I absolutely can rely on the interest rate curves that I can derive from the Bitcoin ecosystem, because I know exactly what the monetary policy of the Bitcoin ecosystem is, and I have confidence that it has not been financialized in a negative way. By that I mean there haven't been derivatives and reapplication of assets where you've got multiple people claiming that they own the very same asset when there's really only one asset. That is endemic in the U.S. financial system, and again, in the Western financial system, that is endemic. And it means that we have no idea what the true price of an asset is. All we can do is look at what our stock market screens or our interest rate screens on our Bloomberg terminals tell us what interest rates are, but that is artificial. And periodically, the free market will rear its head, and the insolvency of the system starts to bubble up to the top. And so far, we've been able to, when I say we, I'm talking about the central banks, have been able to control that insolvency because we've had balance sheets collectively that we can borrow to reflate the bubbles. But I'm pretty sure in my lifetime that we're going to run out of that balance sheet collectively, and we're going to have a much more painful correction than otherwise would have taken place.
Sure, and I guess regardless if you're taking the cryptocurrency ecosystem, the current deficit, the U.S. government, other governments, is a concern, I think, across the board, and sustainability, and, you know, what government programs will look like 10, 20 years out if we keep going at the clip we're going. So I think it's a shared concern, regardless of your take on this issue.
Sure, but it's not just the government. It's really important to say that, because the Japanese government has been levering up like crazy, and yet if you actually look at the private sector balance sheet in Japan, they've been deleveraging like crazy. So in fact, since Japan's bubble burst in the late 80s and early 90s, Japan's balance sheet has actually been repairing itself, in spite of the fact that the government balance sheet has obviously become very, very leveraged. The reason why they've been able to support that level of leverage at the government is because the private sector has been deleveraging, and that's not true in the United States. The private sector has been leveraging up at the same time as the business. When I say private sector, I'm talking about both households and governments. Both households and governments have been leveraging up at the same time as the government has been, and so we basically get all three of the major sectors of the economy levering up at the same time in the U.S. We're all outliving our means, and at some point, that's going to catch up to us. A lot of folks who have been crying fire in the crowded theater, so to speak, broken clocks, you know, right twice a day, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. They're absolutely right in diagnosing the problem. They're wrong in understanding just how far this unstable system can run. And the reason why we've been able, without a dollar collapse, to keep this system going is because for the last four decades, we've been able to live off the balance sheet that our parents and grandparents and their parents and grandparents bequeathed to them. The U.S. had an equity-based economy until 1968. And by that, I mean not that there wasn't debt. There was absolutely debt on the U.S. balance sheet, but all the debt was financed by other American savings, so that in aggregate, there was no debt on the U.S. balance sheet at any given point. There were tiny differences, but the Fed data actually show that from one year to the other, there would be slight increases in non-financial sector debt, and then the next year they'd be paid down relative to savings. It's that differential between the borrowing and the saving that I'm talking about, and that was essentially flat for almost all of U.S. history until 1968, and then we started going to town, and we've been living as a country far beyond our means. Again, what I mean by that is borrowing more than we've been producing. And the New Keynesians would say, well, gosh, we owe it to ourselves, and therefore it's not a problem, and we can just keep going indefinitely and can continue to have what I would argue is dishonest money because we owe it to ourselves, and it's an internal domestic matter. The problem is, of course, that that's not the case, really, because the marginal buyer of U.S. treasuries increasingly is foreign, and we're very dependent upon foreigners to finance the profligacy of the United States, that has huge geopolitical implications. And again, during our lifetime, even in the last 10 years, you really see a power shift that has taken place where countries that are not exactly America's friends have been standing up and they're building their own financial systems. They're building their own versions of SWIFT in order to get out from underneath U.S. control of the global financial system.
You raise a lot of interesting points that I would love to unpack. Maybe, well, just one clarifying question. When you refer to 1968, what was the pivot point there? And as I'm thinking about that era, I think of the decision to move the U.S. dollar as a global reserve off of the gold backing, or at least an implicit gold backing. You know, central banks using it as a reserve and then in theory being backed by a certain amount. Was there some other event that you were referring to when you mentioned 1968?
Well, that was the event that precipitated the U.S. going off the gold standard 3 years later in 1971.
71.
So
that's right.
We were cheating as a country, and it was during the guns and butter period, right? It was during the Vietnam War, and it was both domestic spending and international spending for the war that caused the U.S. to basically become insolvent, and France demanded their gold back in, I believe it was 1969, and finally, after playing, you know, after tap dancing for a while, Nixon finally, temporarily, in air quotes, opened the gold window. And of course, nothing in government is ever temporary, especially when it comes to something like finances. And of course, we never went back to the gold standard. I will say a couple of important things. One is there's nothing magical about gold. Gold was just an anchor, a solid anchor that had a low stock to flow ratio, that ended up being, a high stock to flow ratio that ended up being stable. And that's what anchored the U.S. dollar so that we didn't actually have, any way to cheat, if you will, and to lever up as an economy. And it's not a coincidence that we started levering up as an economy and moved away from that equity-financed economy to a debt-financed economy really right before we went off the gold standard. The second point that I would make, and this gets back to the cryptocurrency questions you're asking, a lot of folks think cryptocurrency shouldn't have value because it's not backed by anything. And they're getting that from the notion that the dollar was backed by gold. To your point, all the way up until 1971. But here's the reality. Money's value is always subjective. It doesn't need to be backed by anything. Gold as money wasn't backed by anything, right? What it was a honest ledger system. It comes back to this boring but very simple concept that people want to hold their wealth in a ledger system that has a finite number of entries in it that no one else can manipulate. Whatever we use as money kind of doesn't matter in its form as long as everyone understands that it's honest. And there have been great books. The most recent one that I read on monetary history is called The Bitcoin Standard by Saifedean Ammous. And he talks about raystones, R-A-I, raystones, that were just literally rocks that were used as money very successfully for centuries. So they didn't necessarily have to have any intrinsic value or have anything that backed their value. It was always subjective. And once you get past the notion that something of value has to back money, then you can get at what really is money. Money is at bottom a ledger. And the most honest ledger is the one that ultimately will emerge as money. Right now, today, I think most folks believe the U.S. financial system is honest. But I think increasingly folks are waking up to the notion that there is something wrong with it. There is something inherently unstable about it. And indeed, that is in part why the cryptocurrency wave took off as much as it did.
So what do you think, acknowledging this is kind of abstract for, you know, the average listener who's just grown up in this system and hasn't thought much perhaps about alternatives or, you know, systems that used to exist. In modern society, what do things look like with a hard currency? And by things, I mean you know, private spending, public spending, defense budgets? What does that reshaped world in maybe its best imagined form look like in your opinion?
Well, I think it's a much freer world. I think it's a world of where you're devolving power back to the place where it naturally rests, which is with the individual. That's not to say that it's that it's anarchy. Not at all. Everything's voluntary at that point. Mm-hmm. But what it does is reduce power away from huge organizations, including centralized governments. Right? It's sort of the Tenth Amendment, the original founding fathers' vision of the U.S. Constitution was that rights that were not explicitly defined in the Constitution went to the states. It wasn't until in jurisprudence that the Interstate Commerce Clause was interpreted as giving the federal government tremendous power. That is not, for example, something that I think our founding fathers in the United States would recognize. That was certainly not in what they intended, and yet it has been reinterpreted to give tremendous power to the federal government. If we go back to honest money, it would devolve power back to local communities, local towns. I live in a neighborhood that owns my streets. We all collectively own our streets together, and we pay for all of the upkeep of the streets, and frankly, we can make our own rules about what can be used in terms of, you know, scooters and golf carts and things like that on our own streets, because we own our own streets. And I think we will devolve back to those kinds of governmental units where participation in those kinds of services is voluntary. And frankly, I'm optimistic that it would be a more peaceful world. I think a tremendous amount of the geopolitical strife. If you study history, you understand that most wars have an origin in balance of payments imbalances between countries. We have the mother of all balance of payments imbalances right now building between the United States and China. And it's not a shock if you understand that history that we're starting to see real fissures in the geopolitics between the two countries, because the Chinese are lending the United States money and they're not getting full value for their money back. And I can pretty confidently say they never will, because the U.S. is ultimately going to have to continue to print in order to be able to do that. Now, all that said, I'm not making short-term projections here. If you understand the history, there's a great book called When Money Dies, written by a British historian about hyperinflation in Germany. Money never dies in a straight line. If you look at the hyperinflations, what you really need to look at them is not on a nominal basis, but on a log basis. And what you see, even in the Venezuelan one, which is happening as we speak, you see rip your face off rallies in markets that make it seem like, oh, we've finally come out the other side. And so you can't actually make money just by simply shorting the currency, because it's obvious that, you know, the decline is in and the bottom is coming. You have enormous volatility that builds. And what I took away from that book is that the volatility towards the end, before the collapse of the German currency after World War I, was extreme. You saw 20-30% intraday moves in the foreign exchange rate against the French franc, and at the end, 50% intraday moves in the stock market. That kind of volatility, you know, is coming. And so it's not easy to trade these things, but I can see, again, all of the historical precedent building up to where we are now. I'll just close this point by one of the things I've been thinking about is how many different empires there have been in human history, and what is it that causes empires to die? We are living, you and I, through the American Empire, but why did the Greek Empire collapse? Why did the Roman Empire collapse? Why did the Dutch Empire collapse? Why did the Spanish Empire collapse? Why did the British Empire collapse? There are so many examples of them, and at each point in history, their currency was the world reserve currency, and yet none of them survived. Why is that? That's what I've got very curious about it, and that's what led me to Austrian economics, and ultimately what brings me great confidence in cryptocurrency.
Incredible implications, potentially. When you say the word, you know, collapse, I'm thinking through the near-term transition. You know, let's say that the world is moving toward a hard currency, and maybe that's Bitcoin. But that's going to take 10, 20 years, whatever that number might be. What does that interim transition look like, and how painful could it be? One, and then maybe two, from the U.S. perspective and from other, you know, global reserve currency backers' perspectives, given that having a national currency as a reserve currency endows you with certain diplomatic benefits around the world. It's just one more weapon, albeit an economic one, that provides a certain amount of influence. I mean, what does the transition period look like in your opinion before you get to that end state that you described?
Well, the natural concern for those of us who studied all of this history is that it doesn't end peacefully, but I'm not so sure that that's the case. I think the world is so interconnected now, and the internet brings people together. And one of the things that just was announced today, on the day that we're recording this interview, Blockstream has expanded Blockstream Satellite, which enables the Bitcoin blockchain to run outside of core internet infrastructure on internet service providers that governments may shut down, for example. So, essentially, unless you have an electromagnetic pulse that goes for 24 hours, the Bitcoin blockchain is essentially now, given that it's running on satellites all around the world, 24/7, is immune to being shut down. So all that says to me that this is actually tremendously valuable in devolving power back to individuals, and we are going to see more and more individuals voluntarily choosing to store more of their wealth in an honest form of money, on an honest ledger. And as the dishonesty of the existing system and instability, unfairness of the existing system becomes better understood, more and more people will simply vote with their feet. And will there be pain for folks who haven't listened to your podcast or read history? Yes, I think that there will be, unfortunately. But that's the reality. I've done a lot of reading and talking to people who have lived through periods of enormous economic strife in various countries, and it definitely opened my eyes to the notion that you need to read and understand things. In some ways, I talk to people, and we conclude, gosh, this is a negative view of the world. Unfortunately, I think that it is a realistic view of the world. But what brings me great optimism is the notion that for the first time in human history, and I really need to underscore that, for the first time in human history, we have a means by which to opt out of the system that sort of forces us into dishonest monetary systems, and that is cryptocurrencies. They are not ever going to be fully controlled by governments. They're not ever fully going to be able to be shut down. And if they do live up to their potential as honest money, as in honest ledgers, then I think over time people will just voluntarily adopt them. So that's the optimistic view, which is that this will just happen voluntarily, and that's where money will be transitioned, and it will be peaceful.
Well, let's hope so, if that comes to pass. On that point, and on the satellite reference you made, kind of the second prong of the framework I was thinking through earlier is how will the incumbents react?
Sure.
You know, the existing holders of the fiat torch. Do you think that incumbent governments can kill Bitcoin, or at this point is it more or less impervious? Let's say in a hypothetical, you know, all governments around the world, which I think is a somewhat unrealistic scenario, come together in trying to eliminate this as a perceived threat to, you know, their autonomy. Do you think it's even possible? Or do you think that network is too dispersed at this point?
It's the latter. At this point, I think it's way too dispersed. It's way too decentralized. With some of the newer coins, I think governments certainly could. It's the same thing as SEC Chairman Clayton has said, that, you know, in the beginning, he hasn't definitively said this, but this is the implication of his remarks, that in the beginning, Bitcoin and Ethereum were probably securities, right? They were started by a group of people, and they were not decentralized, and essentially the participants in the network were reaping the rewards of a management team, quote unquote. And then at some point over time, they became so decentralized that nobody controlled them. And the only two that the SEC has ever spoken so in these terms are Bitcoin and Ethereum. And I think they're right. I think both of those are outside of even a state actor's reach. If you look at the probability that a state actor could amass the hash power to take over the Bitcoin blockchain, it's very low, and the cost benefit to a private actor is so skewed. It's really important to dig into the asymmetric implications of the beautiful asymmetry, I call it, of Bitcoin. The reason it hasn't been hacked is not because the technology isn't hackable. It is. All technology is hackable. The reason it hasn't been successfully hacked is it comes down to simple economics. It would cost more to hack Bitcoin than it would than the hacker would gain from hacking it. So mm-hmm. If it's going to cost them more, they're not going to do it. That is ultimately why I think that these systems are protected against incumbents. Now, and in fact, actually, we're going the opposite direction, which is that big incumbents like the New York Stock Exchange, like Fidelity, yeah. like Citigroup, are actually getting into Bitcoin trading. And I think in some ways that's going to actually help stave off any adverse regulatory actions against it. They've already thrown in the towel. They recognize the time to have fought it was 2012, 2013. It's way too late now.
When was it actually killable?
Yes, it would have been, yeah.
Yeah. Do you think there are any implications of other governments that are trying to harness maybe state-controlled blockchain solutions to issue independent digital currencies? So from my understanding, I think China is exploring this and has been pretty heavy-handed locally in terms of controls on exchanges or actually a bar on exchanges to which the population reverted to the dark market exchange of crypto. Do you think that a state like that could disrupt the market through some type of state-facilitated blockchain currency?
I don't think it would disrupt the market because, again, people are looking for honest ledgers, and it's like the petro in Venezuela. Everyone understands that's not an honest ledger, and there's no way to verify that the oil they claim is backing it is actually backing it, right? So
sure.
Just because it happens to have the technology, I've never seen it, by the way. I can't verify that it has the technology, but just because it does, if it does, doesn't mean that it's going to succeed. And the same thing is true in China. Or any other state. Marshall Islands is looking at a state-issued cryptocurrency. It all comes down to the monetary policy. It all comes down to, is this a legitimate money? Is it an honest ledger? And if it is honest, then frankly, the government can't control it, and governments want to control money. It's the one thing they should not be controlling, and yet it's the first and foremost thing that they all want to control. So. That is why I think ultimately they won't cede power over it as easily as the optimists hope.
Do you think we could live in a world with multiple hard cryptocurrencies, or do you think that the Bitcoin will ultimately prevail and that it will have a dominant 90% plus or whatever the number is market cap over other maybe local alternatives?
Well, yes, I do think that Bitcoin ends up being what we today call money, because folks will eventually migrate to it voluntarily, and again, hopefully not during a crash. But it is pretty clear that it's not connected to the existing system. It's completely outside of it, and therefore, if you own your real if you hold your private keys to your Bitcoin, then you have sovereignty over your assets. I think we will ultimately see multiple cryptocurrencies. I'm not a Bitcoin maximalist in the short term, and I welcome all of the innovations that are taking place in other cryptocurrencies. The great thing about the governance process for Bitcoin is that the developers it's an open source project. They look at whatever, at everything else that's happening out there in innovations in this area. And if something comes through that is a true breakthrough, they'll just adopt it in Bitcoin. In fact, actually, developers tell me there's not much left of the original Satoshi code. It's 10 years old now, and most of it's been rewritten. And I think 10 years from now, most of what we have today will also have been rewritten. We're going to be calling it Bitcoin, but it's going to evolve, and it's going to adapt the best of the technology, and all these altcoins are proving ground. One other related answer to your question is, I think we're going to see real estate and securities and other forms of assets issued in blockchain form. And so we're going to end up having lots of different blockchain assets, but they're what we would call today deeds for real estate or securities for stocks and bonds. They're all going to be issued in blockchain form in probably in the next 20 years.
So I'd love to jump into security tokens, maybe first on the governance point. Do you see any threat to the ecosystem from contentious hard forks like the one that happened around this time last year around SegWit and the increase in block size ultimately resulted in Bitcoin Cash for the more recent Bitcoin Cash conflict that resulted in ABC and SV, those two independent chains? In terms of implementing new features that, you know, let's say the majority or somewhat less than the majority of participants think would be an absolute improvement to the Bitcoin core code?
Well, sure. Governance is always messy. And what's interesting about open source projects is that the governance fights are out in the open. But I, having worked in investment banking, you work in investment banking, we see what's going on in the boardroom. Governance fights are nasty. And and it just so happens that every now and then there's going to be something contentious and the board's going to split. For the most part, in my experience, having been on different boards, boards vote unanimously. It's usually obvious what the answers are, but when there's a dissension, it's typically a close vote, and it's, you know, once every couple years, something very controversial arises, and the board, has great dissension, and those fights are usually played out behind closed doors, but in Bitcoin, they're going to be played out, and in any open source project, they're going to be played out, publicly. I think at the end of the day, that's all healthy. There were a number of folks who wanted to take Bitcoin into a different direction, Bitcoin Cash. I absolutely support their right to exist. I'm not, you know, in the scrum saying that that's an SH coin. I won't say the word on your show, but I don't think that folks should be going with ad hominem attacks on each other. If there's a group that truly wanted to have higher block size and really felt like it needed to be done in that manner, Godspeed, go forth and multiply and prove, and let's compete in the market to see whether you actually can end up with more users. And absolutely all of this experimentation has a right to exist, and the best is going to bubble up to the top. I'm very much what I would call Mengerian, after economist Carl Menger, in his view of money. Money is whatever the free market wants it to be, and it should be the absolute choice of individuals interacting freely, and interest rates should be set between the voluntary interactions of all borrowers and savers all throughout the yield curve. We should be able to get a free and uncensored, unmanipulated yield curve off the ability for borrowers and savers to interact voluntarily with each other.
One other question on Bitcoin before maybe we jump into security tokens. Are you concerned at all about the concentration of wealth among a relatively small number of addresses, presumably held by early adopters? And yeah, it's a ratio that's, I think, higher than most developed and developing countries. Perhaps you think that's going to evolve over time as the system matures, but, you know, to the extent to which early adopters and hodlers in industry terms, what might that dynamic be? The wealth of this newfound system being controlled by a relatively few number of people whose contribution to the system was significant early on when very few people were backing it up, but, you know, may not have to measure in contribution going forward.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's the by definition, anything, any product that gets its start is going to have concentrated ownership. Any company, any business, any new invention is going to have concentrated ownership. And over time, as it disperses itself, that ownership concentration is going to decline. The data that you cite, I think, picks up something that is misleading. Yeah.
It picks up, I'm sure, I think that some of the numbers that have been cited pick up exchanges that have individual addresses for all of their users. And some other instances like that, lost accounts perhaps, accounts that were held by Satoshi originally.
Definitely. Yeah, no question. And the exchanges are the big wallets, and everyone looks at those and says, my gosh, those exchanges are whales. Well, Coinbase and Kraken and those kinds of companies are places where a lot of folks store their cryptocurrencies. There's an interesting movement that has come up from the grassroots, it's the same folks that got the user-activated soft fork, UASF, activated last year that you alluded to, that showed that really it's the users that control Bitcoin. It's not the miners. It's not even the whales, the so-called whales that have ownership concentration, because in many cases, those whales are not individual people. They're collective omnibus accounts that millions of individuals happen to hold their currencies through. But on the 10th anniversary of the Bitcoin Genesis block, which is January 3rd, there's a movement to get folks to take their coins off exchanges. I lived through this in, I believe it was 2015. There were rumors that Coinbase was having a run on it in 2015. And again, understanding bank run history, I knew exactly that I was exposed to the potential that Coinbase might have been playing three-card Monty behind the scenes. Because let's face it, none of those exchanges have any transparency into whether they're promising more IOUs for cryptocurrency customers than they're actually holding in cryptocurrency. And I wasn't sure whether it would survive. We experienced this in the industry with Mt. Gox in 2013, mm-hmm. right? They were playing three-card Monty, and guess what? There are probably other exchanges playing three-card Monty right now. We just don't know who they are.
Yeah, and there's no coherent regulatory oversight at the moment.
Well, even with regulatory oversight, it's so interesting you said that. I'm a huge skeptic of the success of regulatory oversight at weeding this out for the simple reason that it happens on a sanctioned basis every day in financial markets. And a lot of people like to talk about fractional reserve banking in the traditional banking system. That's not even where the issue is, because at least that's transparent. I can measure how much of that has taken place. The real issue is in the securities markets, where you actually have more rehypothecation than anyone realizes, and it's not measured. What is rehypothecation? It means that when an asset is lent, and most securities are actually held on loan at any given moment in time, they're constantly on the move. When an asset is lent, under the accounting principles, the lender and the borrower both record the asset as if they own it. And then if it's relent and relent and relent and relent, which U.S. Treasuries are relent multiple times a day, no one has any idea how long that so-called collateral chain, which is the number of people who think they own the exact same Treasury security when there's really only one, no one knows how long those collateral chains are. So it's because of ultimately an accounting problem that accounting standards say all of those parties are recording that they own the same asset. Well, when the system periodically freezes up, as it did in 2008 when we had a run on the so-called repo market, we're going to have that again, by the way. That's going to happen again. And when that system freezes up and there's another run on the repo market, what that really is the free market rearing its head and trying to correct for the fact that all this three-card Monty has been played, and none of the regulators have any idea how leveraged the financial system really is. CFTC Chairman Chris Giancarlo, hats off to him. He's been talking about this in his speeches for the last few years, and that's one of the reasons he's a big proponent of blockchain, because he wants to get control of, or at least visibility over, how leveraged the financial system really is. And we're 10 years past the financial crisis, and he acknowledges we don't have that visibility, and he's right.
So that's a natural segue to security tokens.
Sure.
Or, you know, tokens representing ownership in real world assets. How do you think that could potentially solve some of the inefficiencies that you just ran through? And I think you've, at least since BACT was announced, been thinking security tokens in the context of permissionless systems, as opposed to some of the permissioned alternatives that have been proposed through the course of, you know, 2016, 17, and early 2018. How do you think that's going to evolve over the course of the next couple of years?
Yes, I hope that all securities are natively issued on a blockchain because, as you said, that was a good segue into the discussion about security tokens, because what I just laid out for you says that we basically have no clue how many people own the same asset when there's really only one. And whenever there's a run on a system, you see these massive deflationary trends. But it can end up, like I said earlier, with rip your face off short squeezes if the asset has been artificially shorted to a much greater degree than anyone has anticipated. But in any event, that's a dishonest system. In very simple terms, the securities industry is a dishonest system. And it's not nefarious. It's a function of the market structure. It was a poorly designed system that was created because the technology didn't exist to handle the market, the trading volumes that were happening in the early 1970s. And so they created these series of netting mechanisms. This is the reason why it takes you 2 days to settle a stock trade. But the problem is there's counterparty risk. If you buy a share of Apple, you pay your broker-dealer immediately, and then 2 days later, the broker-dealer has to deliver you your share of Apple. Well, what happens if your broker-dealer goes bust in the intervening 2 days? All of a sudden, you're a general creditor of a highly leveraged bankrupt institution. Very few people understand that. There's no natural reason why the buyer and seller of Apple stock should end up having to face that counterparty risk, but that is inherent in a bad market structure. And all of these, basically blockchain technology is the technology that can fix that bad market structure. Why hasn't it been fixed? A, it's inertia. B, it's regulatory cruft, right? It's hard to go to completely change a regulatory apparatus that has tens of thousands of pages of regulation that's been built up around this system of layered intermediaries that we've had for the last 40 years. And see, there are a lot of incumbents who are making money off this existing system, as unfair and unstable as it is. And I would say number four, the fiduciaries who should be pushing to fix it. These are the pension funds, the endowments, the foundations, the mutual funds, the people who own real assets on behalf of their customers. They should be pushing to fix it, but they haven't. I think they're afraid to look under the hood and realize. I think it was Henry Ford who said that if anybody understood how the financial system really worked, they'd take all their money home and stash it in their mattress. I'm not doing his quotation justice, but he's right. It's an inherently unstable system, and God forbid you don't want to get stuck with all your savings in that system when it has a crack. And again, it's going to crack during our lifetime. Will it be able to recover again like it did after 2008? We'll see. But again, with each crack, it gets deeper and deeper in terms of the magnitude of the corrections, and there are shorter periods in between these major cracks. So security tokens are inherently going to be able to solve that fundamental problem and make it obvious that the shares that you own are going to be, you can verify that they were legally issued and authorized on a blockchain, because you'll be able to trace back to the genesis moment where the shares were registered with the Secretary of State that they were legitimately legally authorized. I'll close this section with a couple of points. I was working with the state of Delaware. We went to see the SEC at one point. The Secretary of State of Delaware talked about a couple of instances where there were publicly traded companies that had more shares issued than then legally authorized in Delaware. And it usually comes up in contested proxy battles. And there was a very famous case that happened in 2017, so quite recent, related to Dole Food, where there were more than it was a merger, and the merger is sort of a reckoning event, right, that forces a true-up of all these inaccurate ledger systems that Wall Street uses among all these various intermediaries that don't settle trades on a real-time basis. And in the Dole Food case, there was more than one-third extra shares issued legally. Well, they weren't shares. There were more than one-third extra claims, valid claims to Dole Food shares than there were legally issued Dole Food shares outstanding. And they were all supported by brokerage statements. I've seen that in my pension business, where I came across a situation where there was unauthorized securities lending. It would not have been discovered by the brokerage statements. Only when there's some sort of a reckoning event and you have to true up the system do you realize how overissued the securities actually are. And the problem is that's picking the pockets of mom and pop. It's unfair. It's wrong. And blockchain is a solution to all of this.
And so for clarification purposes, as I'm thinking through how you laid out security tokens, it's essentially a market structure solution that better tracks ownership and
yes.
reduces, if not eliminates, duplicate claims.
Exactly.
It would still be subject to some type of, if not the existing disclosure regime. You know,
100%. Definitely. Yep.
And then, you know, are any implication on, I would think it would be subject to, as you've laid it out, governance is laid out by state law, subject to other states competing as they do now and will continue to do in the future, Delaware having incumbent advantage at the moment. Or is there some type of fundamental governance change that you think could be effectuated through state-related or state-level token regimes like that in Wyoming that you work to get pushed through?
Well, what we're trying to do in Wyoming, it's a good question, because right now, technically, it's not possible to issue on a permissionless blockchain security tokens. That legal regime doesn't exist. So one of the things I've been doing for the past year is working in my native state as a volunteer in Wyoming to build a legal foundation for permissionless blockchains that solves some pretty basic legal questions like, can they legally be issued in blockchain form in the case of securities? You know, can we get the Secretary of State to be an oracle on a blockchain for smart contract purposes so that you can go back and verify that the shares you were purchasing were not duplicates and were legally valid and true shares where you're the direct owner of the shares? We're also working to clarify the exact status of blockchain assets in bankruptcy. So some of these things are pretty fundamental to allowing securities to be issued in blockchain form. But once we get them done, and again, Wyoming's seeking out a leadership role, I think, you know, for you attorneys who are listening to the podcast, you're going to say, wow, when you see what Wyoming does, assuming everything passes in the legislative session that's coming up in the next couple of months, because we're going to have legal clarity, and it's going to be inside the United States, which, of course, is a jurisdiction where a lot of folks, for legal reasons, want to be, and there's going to be one state that gives you absolute legal clarity around the status of your assets. And again, it's all got to pass. It's a legislative session, so I'm not counting my chickens before they're hatched. But if it does pass, then Wyoming will be the only place in the world that provides that clarity.
I understand. I'm looking forward to seeing how that unfolds.
Yeah, thank you. It's going to be great fun. I'm not saying it's going to be perfect. We are coming with a technical corrections bill this year to one of the bills we passed last year because the language, for example, didn't authorize banks to hold their books and records on a blockchain. Well, we're going to fix that this year. You know, things like that are going to happen. But we are definitely going to have a improved legal regime and much clearer legal regime in order to facilitate the development of this industry.
Interesting. Maybe one more question on security tokens. I've seen a lot of projects that have benefited security tokens in terms of opening up liquidity to underserved asset classes. So I don't know, let's say LP interests, esoterics, art, real estate, whatever that might be.
Yep.
If I think through those applications, I'm just still thinking in my mind, well, subject to having good disclosure. And I'm not sure that having security tokens is what's going to open up those markets. It seems like more of a disclosure problem to me. I'm not sure if you've thought about the application of security tokens beyond existing traded assets like stocks and bonds?
Well, sure. Disclosure is, you know, sunlight is the best disinfectant, right? But, you know, real estate, there's very little disclosure in real estate, almost none. And that market is pretty liquid. And I think the vast majority of security tokens, where we're going to be bringing new people to these markets, is bringing foreigners into these markets. Stay tuned, because there's some big things that are on track in this industry in 2019 that are going to enable someone in a remote village in Southeast Asia to take a tokenized interest, invest in a tokenized interest in a New York City apartment building. Right now, they wouldn't have the ability to do that, or for that matter, in, you know, a Renoir painting. Right now, no one's got the ability to do that. You're either buying the whole thing or you're not buying it at all. And we're going to democratize access to capital, and these systems are going to be able to do that. Now, that said, I think there was a presumption in your question that the disclosure requirements are a good thing to protect investors. I would take issue with that with regard to startups. I think it's very clear that the Jobs Act, which was intended to help facilitate the formation of capital to support startups, that still is way too bureaucratic. And to me, the evidence of that, and it requires too much disclosure on the part of the issuers of the securities. The evidence of that is what happened in the ICO market. We proved that we could actually bring together pools of capital without having to go to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees, which, let's face it, most startups don't have hundreds of thousands of dollars to pay lawyers to do SEC filings. And most startups don't have financial history that they can provide in their disclosures. So if you have to have financial history and you have to pay lawyers hundreds of thousands of dollars, what's the chance that you're going to be accessing capital through those systems? It's pretty close to nil. And so I think it's pretty clear Reg A Plus, the Jobs Act, failed, and it's still way too high a bar, and we need to reduce that bar to get to what really matters in the disclosure for investors, as opposed to all this bureaucratic requirements that's very prescriptive and, frankly, is an impediment to capital formation in the United States.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people would point to the decline in listed public companies and the increasing propensity for companies to raise private capital at increasing high valuations in support of that, regardless of what you map out as the solution. Seems like there are definitely some symptoms there.
Oh, for sure, for sure. It's less than half the number of public companies outstanding today than 20 years ago. And that's a function of course, a number of things, one of which is interest rates being so manipulated that large companies end up with subsidized cost of capital relative to small companies. And so what that naturally does is concentrate power in industries. And it's pretty much every industry. We've got giants that have taken over, and so many industries. I'm thinking of the airlines, the hotels, the tech companies, the healthcare companies. There's just been so much consolidation because there's a cost of capital advantage to being a gigantic company that is not natural and would not exist if it were, if markets were free. I think we'll get to a fairer capital market, not just for investors, but also for issuers, if those sorts of non-market, non-free market advantages go away. There's another advantage that doesn't have anything to do with blockchain, but it's worth calling out. Banks lend to large companies at a loss. They are allowed under antitrust laws to do that, to tie their investment banking services to their loan book. And so banks will lend to the highest rated companies, the Johnson & Johnsons, the Procter & Gambles of the world, at a loss. And then they'll try to make it back on, you know, derivatives and cash management services and mergers and acquisitions and other fees that are paid to the banks. That is also something that encourages the power concentration within large companies. And that is not a natural market phenomenon. In a true free market, that would not exist.
Shifting gears to one last topic, acknowledging it's largely been around crypto and in terms of currency and store value use cases, and then security tokens as a market structure improvement. Have you thought much about decentralized applications on smart contract platforms, acknowledging that that's maybe the venue more so of technologists than of financiers? And it feels like there are two fundamentally different camps, those who are real strong proponents of cryptocurrency is, for, I guess, economic and political reasons, and those who are looking at tech incumbents like Facebook and Google and Amazon, who have a ton of power in centralized silos, and thinking through how you build fatter protocols across not just cryptocurrencies, but just about any service on top of decentralized blockchains as an alternative tech system. Have you thought much about that?
Oh, yes, but I don't see them as mutually exclusive. I realize, as you point out, some people do, but I don't. I see them as completely parallel and complementary systems. I'm a big supporter of smart contracts platforms, having worked at Symbiont previously, which is a permissioned smart contract system, and obviously Ethereum and its similar competitors in the permissionless systems. To me, they're two different things. I realize that, again, some folks want Ether to be a competitor to Bitcoin, but I don't think it ever will be. It wasn't designed to do the same thing. As long as we can operate within the two systems, there's no reason why they can't coexist. And I think they will.
Maybe one other derivation on that question. Do you think the case for blockchain and a decentralized stack can be more compelling in applications beyond currency, or do you think currency is the case for which blockchain technology makes the most sense?
Well, currency is definitely the case for which blockchain technology makes the most sense. I think the smart contract applications for digital collectibles make tremendous sense. And thinking about CryptoKitties, mm-hmm. As an example, that, as much as everyone loves to sort of point at it and laugh, that proves that digital collectibles can and are a great use case for the smart contract-based platforms. And that technology is a proving ground for applying it to things like real-world art and real-world securities and real-world real estate and real-world supply chains. All of those things, I think, ultimately will be blockchain-based, if not in their entirety, then in the portion of information that is designed to be shared by multiple parties that today is duplicated and reconciled, which adds a tremendous amount of cost and time and inefficiency in those systems, will be able to take out and solve the duplication and reconciliation problem by using a blockchain for storing that particular type of information that is meant to be shared by multiple parties.
Sure. So I guess anywhere where you have a digital asset, you'd also like to introduce a finite number of. So maybe music would be another example as a way for the artist to regain control of supply.
Sure. Some of the earliest smart contract platform applications on Ethereum were digital rights management platforms. It's a perfect example of something that really doesn't make sense to do in analog form. And if it's a truly decentralized system like managing rights to an artist's song, if they decide they want to release their song on a decentralized platform, Godspeed. And if they want to decide to release their song on a centralized traditional platform, Godspeed. And over time, I think the decentralized ones will win out. But as with so many different markets, it's going to take years, and you've got a lot of incumbents that are standing in the way and not making it easy for the artists to release their work on those decentralized platforms. But I think in 20 years, we will be there.
Well, it'll be interesting to see unfold. Well, I really enjoyed the conversation. Is there anything else that's top of mind for you, any trends in the industry that you've been thinking a lot about recently that we haven't covered?
No, I think you've got it. I think the intersection of Wall Street and the crypto asset market is going to be a fascinating area to watch. We're going through what I would call the walled garden phase right now, the intranet, not the internet phase, where everybody's trying to to take, you know, work on hybrid products and take baby steps toward blockchain. But I think just as with stable coins, which are crypto-based fiat proxies, so crypto-based dollar or yen or euro proxies, that came out from out of left field from the crypto industry and has overtaken a project that the banks have been working on for years called utility settlement coin. It's more than 3 years old, hasn't made much progress, and here comes stable coins that you now have in regulated form, you know, from out of left field, and it just outflanked the existing system. We're going to see more and more and more of those examples, and it's going to be very, very positive for mom-and-pop investors, most especially.
Very interesting. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Really appreciate your time. Thank you. I enjoyed it.